Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Deborah England, Senior Program Officer at the Corrett Foundation, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Tobey Family Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, William Eggers, co-author of the book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. William Eggers is one of the country's best-known authorities on government reform. An author, columnist, and popular speaker for two decades, he has built a significant following among public sector thought leaders in the U.S., Canada, and overseas. Mr. Eggers has advised dozens of cities, states, and foreign countries and trained hundreds of public officials on government restructuring. He is a sought-after speaker, giving close to 100 speeches per year. Currently, as the Global Director for Deloitte Research and Executive Director of Deloitte's Public Leadership Institute, he is responsible for research and thought leadership for Deloitte's public sector practice. Mr. Eggers is a former appointee to the U.S. Office of Management and Budget's Performance Measurement Advisory Commission, and he is the former Project Director for the Texas Performance Review. He was involved in two performance reviews, in which he identified over $2.5 billion worth of savings and non-tax revenues for the state. More than 60% of the recommendations in the reviews were enacted into law. Mr. Eggers also served as a commissioner for the Texas Incentive and Productivity Commission and a designee on the Texas Council on Competitive Government. Mr. Eggers is a former senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the former director of government reform at the Reason Foundation. Earlier, he assisted reformers in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union with the transition to market economies. Mr. Eggers' previous books on government reform include Government 2.0, Using Technology to Improve Education, Cut Red Tape, Reduce Gridlock, and Enhance Democracy, and Revolution at the Roots, Making Our Government Smaller, Better, and Closer to Home. Mr. Eggers' commentary has also appeared in dozens of major media outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, San Francisco Chronicle, and Orange County Register. Please welcome Mr. William Eggers.
Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having me here. It's really an honor to speak. It's great to be here in beautiful, sunny California. You've got to love the weather. I'm particularly pleased to be here tonight because so many of my friends and colleagues and many of my relatives are here. My brother and his wife are in the back, and a lot of my cousins have a whole row there, so it really means a lot to me tonight. So if we can put a man on the moon, how many times have you heard that phrase? If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we cure homelessness? If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we fix our schools? Or from my favorite source of news, The Onion, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we make killer robot police? Now, it didn't start off as a cliche, of course. It started off as a challenge issued by President John F. Kennedy in 1961.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space.
I usually give the presentation with my co-author, John O'Leary, who's from Massachusetts. He does a wicked Kennedy impression that usually gets a big ovation. And since I couldn't do that, you got the real thing here. Now, it was an impossible challenge, but America pulled together. In July 1969, Neil Armstrong planted a flag on the moon. Now, the trip to the moon inspired a generation. It was climbing Mount Everest, flying across the Atlantic, and reaching the North Pole, all rolled into one. No one who was alive at that time, and I know a lot of you were alive then, could forever forget that feeling of pride at that moment. Do you remember that? Most of you probably remember exactly where you were at the time. It made an impact on every American, particularly the young, including our president, Barack Obama, who said, as a young boy, he remembered growing up in Hawaii, sitting on my grandfather's shoulders, watching the Apollo astronauts come ashore. My grandfather explained with pride and assurance how we Americans could accomplish anything we set our minds to do. Now, who could argue that American government wasn't capable after we put a man on the moon? We had won World War II, we'd helped rebuild Europe through the Marshall Plan, and we built the National Highway System. We were justifiably proud of our accomplishments. But is our government today capable of executing against our most important challenges? Now, recent events aren't likely to lead to any ticker tape parades. Iraq, Katrina, the Big Dig and its collapsing tunnel, the brutal economic meltdown. We're once again facing questions about our government's ability to execute. Political observers believe we have a crisis. The man on the street believes we have a crisis. As part of the book tour, I've been doing radio interviews, and people are mad. They're angry at Wall Street, but also at our government today. And those who run our government's programs, our most senior executives, actually also believe we have a crisis. We surveyed members of our senior executive service, our nation's most senior executives. 60% said that government today is less capable of executing than it was 30 years ago. Now, most people will then ask, who's to blame for this state of affairs? And the answer, of course, depends on whose side you're on. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Newt Gingrich, Nancy Pelosi, the Republicans, the Democrats, the greedy contractors, the unions, Michael Moore, Rush Limbaugh. Who's to blame? It's a natural question to ask, but is it the right question to ask? Whenever something goes wrong, the natural tendency is to find someone to blame. All you need to do is go visit a local bookstore and go into the current events section. It's filled with villains. Now, Ann Coulter, of course. I wanted us to appear on the cover of our book in short black mini dresses. When my brother Dave talked me out of it. There's always the paperback version, though. So instead of who's to blame, we asked a different question. We asked the question, why do some big initiatives fail, and why do some succeed? To answer that question, we studied more than 75 major undertakings since World War II. To look for both, they were both great successes and monumental failures. We wanted to look for patterns. We looked at everything from the success of the Marshall Plan to the struggles of immigration reform. We looked at the wars on poverty, the wars on inflation, to real wars in Iraq and Vietnam. Now, when we began this task of reviewing all of these initiatives, we realized that to do it right would require a small army of intelligent, thoughtful individuals who understood government and were willing to work for free. And so the answer was clear. We needed grad students. With the help of more than 70 grad students, we sought to understand the factors behind success and failure. To understand the essential question of the difference between a government that is mired in failure and a government that can succeed, we were looking for a path to success. Now, my co-author and I, we each bring a distinct perspective to this issue. John is an engineer by training, an MIT engineer, and he develops a process map for making toast in the morning. And so like any good engineer, what John did was he said, we need to look at this and break it down into its discrete processes. And we found that while they were all very different, all of these initiatives, they actually followed a predictable path, a series of steps that we call the journey to success. Now, there are lots of ways an initiative can end in disaster, but to have a happy ending, the following must occur. You must have a good idea. You must have an implementable design. The design must win approval, what we call signaling a moment of democratic commitment. It's when it goes through the legislature, and we actually call that Stargate. My engineer co-author came up with that name, and it's because, like the science fiction series, when you walk through the political Stargate, you instantly travel from one universe, which is the political universe, to another universe, which is the bureaucratic universe. And these are radically different places, which we'll talk about. There must be competent implementation, and the initiative must generate its desired results. So we use this map to help guide our inquiry. We discovered by simply visualizing as a map really helped to identify the root causes. Now, I'm a consultant, and so my perspective is a bit different. The consultants are often called in when an initiative is in the ditch and they need to get it out of it. And I'm also a bit of a pessimist. So this map, while technically correct, it really doesn't reflect the real world that I see every day of government and government initiatives. So I tend to look at all the possible problems to scope out all the systemic barriers to success, because the potential for failure lurks everywhere anytime you do a major government initiative. And so we identified 7 hidden pitfalls, what we call the 7 deadly traps on this journey to success. Now, we're not going to go through all 7 of the traps today, but to learn about them, you're going to actually have to read the book, which means you're going to have to buy the book, which is available afterwards. I'm told they make for fine holiday presents coming up. And so you take the process map, and then you take the traps, and you put those together, and then you have actually the map, which we think is the more realistic map of how to get big things done in government. And it looks a little bit like that. And there are actually copies of the map behind you. So we're going to start off by looking at the idea phase. Not all ideas are created equal. The pogo copter was a bad idea. It got a patent, even. New Coke, bad idea. So was the electric fort. And a really bad idea was Gerald Ford's whip inflation now buttons. Who remembers those? Do you remember those buttons? Who wore them? Anyone here wear them? These buttons, essentially, Whip Inflation Now campaign was designed to actually how we were going to whip double-digit inflation. It's bad, bad idea. Now, how did ideas like this come into place? Well, ideas are really the first phase in the public policy process. And you can't have a successful initiative if you've got a flawed idea. Bad ideas generally become reality when they aren't exposed to external criticism. This phenomenon is called Tolstoy syndrome, named after Count Leo Tolstoy. And it's the biggest trap in the idea stage. It occurs when people or groups shut themselves off from critics, from those who think differently than they do. A few years ago, a professor named Drew Western, who's out of the University of Georgia, he studies how the brain works. And he wanted to conduct an experiment. So he had ardent Republicans and ardent Democrats watch a debate between President George Bush and Senator John Kerry. But there's a twist. While they watched the debate, he had their heads all wired up so he could monitor their brains. They were wired up to an MRI machine. Looked a little bit like that. Available on eBay for $29.95. Weston found that Republicans thought that Bush had won, Democrats thought that Kerry had won, and both sides ignored it when their guy was being inconsistent. No surprise there. But what was really surprising was that the part of the brain that was activated during the debate was not the thinking part at all. It was the emotional part of the brain. Those viewing the debate weren't thinking at all, it turns out. They were just pulling for their guy. Now, this phenomenon is called confirmation bias. It's when we aren't open to new ways of thinking, when our brain is shut off to diverse viewpoints, and it causes a lot of problems. And just think about the world that we're living in today, where so much of the news we get and what people watch, it confirms our views rather than informs them. And I think if you look at the root of a lot of our big problems today, this is one of the things that we found time and time again. So what's the answer to this? How do you fix it? The answer is to expose these ideas to new ways of thinking, to bring in new perspectives. Kind of like having an engineer and a consultant look at the same problem. Now, that's the approach that was used to solve one of the biggest environmental successes of the 1980s, one of the biggest environmental problems, which was acid rain. Now, my family, we grew up in a suburb on Lake Michigan. We were about a mile from the beach, and my family is crazy about the beach. We absolutely love going to the beach, but throughout most of my childhood, we never actually got to go to the beach. Why? It was covered in dead fish, really ugly dead fish. And so why was it covered in dead fish? Because of something called acid rain. Acid rain occurs when coal-burning plants send invisible pollution up into the atmosphere. It goes up into the clouds where it gets absorbed. And then it goes about hundreds of miles, and it actually lands somewhere else. And it kills lakes and rivers and the animals and wildlife within it. Now, it was the biggest environmental issue of the 1980s. So you'd think something would have been done about it. Unfortunately, the debate about acid rain had devolved into two camps. You had environmentalists on one side who basically wanted to eliminate all pollution. You had coal-burning plants, business interests on the other side who believed that regulation would actually kill jobs and put them out of business. Now, each of them was locked into their worldview. They didn't just disagree, they despised each other. There was an impasse. 70 bills were authored in Congress to address acid rain. Not a single one made it out of Congress. Into this quagmire came two senators. Senator Tim Worth from Colorado, a Democrat. Senator Jack Hines from Pennsylvania, a Republican. So here's how they broke through the logjam. Into the room of environmentalists and business interests, they brought in economists to look at the problem. The economists they brought in were actually from a think tank out here in San Francisco called Environmental Defense Fund. And one of the guys' name was Robert Stavins. And by giving the problem to an economist, they took it out of the realm of the absolutists on each side. They looked at it like an economics problem. And you all, are there any economists in the room here, by the way? One economist? Well, you know what they say about economists, don't you? Economists are really good with numbers, but they lack the personality to become engineers. So the economist's solution was creative. They capped the amount of pollution at half the previous level, and then instead of a command and control approach, they left it up to the market to decide how to meet that pollution level, not the EPA or the California Department of Environmental Quality. Energy producers could then use any means they wanted to get under that cap. It was workable, it was simple, it was acceptable to both sides. It was one of the biggest environmental successes of recent decades. Resulted in a 40% reduction in carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide emissions, a 40-to-1 cost-benefit ratio, and most importantly, by the time my little brother Toph came along, our hometown beach was free of dead fish. So overcoming the Tolstoy syndrome is all about listening. If we think we know the answer, we close off all these avenues of exploration. So now let's go to the design stage. And let's go back a few years ago to something you all experienced here. In the 1990s in California had a problem. Some things, I guess, never change. But the economy was in a slump. And in part was because of high energy prices. And then Governor Wilson, the legislature, had an idea. What if we replace public monopolies with a competitive market and the goal, innovation and cost savings? Now, it was not a fundamentally crazy idea. Deregulation was largely successful in the trucking and airline industries in the 1970s. But the results would all depend on the legislation, on how it was designed. Now, the design of the new electricity market was really, really quite simple. Power generators had to divest themselves of transmission lines, which meant that they had to be able to recover stranded costs in the investments they had made because the old monopoly generators would turn the operation of the transmission grid over to the state. The new monopoly operated the grid, and it would also meant the state would run something called the California Power Exchange, which was a giant electricity auction, but not a regular auction because an auction held 24 hours in advance, which was necessary because the generators were prohibited. You got that? Not many people really understood how the new system would work, including most of the legislators. But you know who figured out how this whole system would work? Who figured it out? Enron. Enron and a few other firms understood this new system better than the system's creators, better than the regulators. Enron soon figured out how to profit from the loopholes in the new design, using schemes with cute names like Ricochet, Fat Boy, and Death Star. Enron learned that it could ship low-cost juice out of California into Nevada, send it back over the grid to Oregon at a higher price, and make a huge profit for doing nothing at all, because electricity travels at the speed of light. So in the summer of 2000, the crisis hit. And you all know how the story goes from here. You all lived through it. There is a heat wave. Got up to about 109 degrees in San Jose. It recorded the highest temperatures you'd ever seen in Pac Bell Park. Energy demand shot up, and the lights went out. The weird phenomenon of rolling blackouts became a feature of life in California. In Silicon Valley, the global center of high technology had an electricity supply of a third world nation. They were using electrical generators or people on bicycles to generate electricity. Electricity prices skyrocketed. Just 2 years into the law, after the law had been passed, total meltdown. The result, billions of dollars were lost by you consumers, billions of dollars were lost by the state. Governor Gray Davis was kicked out of office. So how did such a bill, a badly designed bill, become law? Huh? And that's where the process gets really, really scary. Why? Because it was an exemplary process. They had hearings, they had meetings, they visited other jurisdictions. It was bipartisan cooperation. They worked till late at night. They did such a good job that the law passed unanimously. 98 to nothing. And as you know, nothing passes California legislature unanimously. Nobody voted against it. So what was the problem? The problem was the legislation. They didn't design it to work in the real world. The California legislature saw itself as crafting a bill that could pass. And they wanted to see as many votes as they could get. So they baked in a lot of stuff to make everybody happy. But the problem was the different parts didn't work together. As a system, the design wouldn't hold up to the likes of Enron. Now, California electricity deregulation points to a big factor behind many large government failures. And that's the root of many so-called implementation failures that you read about in the newspaper all the time actually lies at the design phase. We surveyed members of our senior of the National Academy of Public Administration, and this is what they told us. Only 16% said that federal government actually designs policies that can be implemented. Very similar results when we surveyed members of our senior executive service. Now, it turns out if you want to get a federal senior executive really going, really animated, and it's not always easy to get them animated, all you need to do is ask them about the policy design process. This is what they told us. Policy design at the federal level is pathetic. There is a gap between communication and understanding. Policy design is dictated top-down for ideological partisan reasons. It's done without implementation considerations. There's a big problem here. So what's the cause of this? Now, the civil servants will say it's the politicians. The politicians will say it's the bureaucrats. What we found, actually, was that neither one is the case. The problem was the gap between the two. And it's a gap that's actually gotten bigger in recent years. Now, this wall of separation between those who implement policy and those who design it has a lot of problems. And one of them is that if you're on the policy side of the process, is that success for you equates with getting a bill passed, you know, getting a bill through the legislature or Congress, and then, you know, that's success. But the real goal is way down the line. Nowhere is this more apparent than our 4 decades quest for energy independence. Started in 1974, President Ford signing a law, the Energy Policy and Conservation Act. The goal, energy independence. The result, by 1980, net imports of oil to the United States were 400,000 barrels per day higher than they were in 1973. 1978, President Carter signs the National Energy Act. The goal, derive 20% of all the energy we use from the sun. By the end of the century. The results? Well, we didn't quite get to 20%. By 2000, the sun provided 0.007% of all the energy used in the U.S. 2005, President Bush signs the Energy Policy Act, the goal energy and economic security. The result? The Energy Independence Act of 2007. Now, getting through the legislature, getting through what we call Stargate, is a milestone, but you don't get the ticker tape parade until the results actually roll in. Now, if you forget this, you're going to end up drowning in the river of failure, and that's not a place that you want to be. Our next phase is the implementation phase. And the biggest trap in this phase is overconfidence. This often occurs when really smart, really capable people become overconfident of their abilities and they fail to prepare for all of the risks. I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist that. But implementing complex public initiatives is a lot tougher than it looks. So the key to avoiding failure is to take failure seriously. Now, anyone who's ever done a rehab on your house knows that an estimate of $15,000 in 3 weeks means that actually you should take out a loan for $40,000 and move in with your in-laws, right? And that's how to be successful in these initiatives. So let me give you a quick story. If you're like me, few things get you more frustrated than sitting in traffic. There's one proven way to reduce traffic congestion, and that's to charge people for the use of the roads during rush hour. It's called congestion pricing, and economists have been talking about it for decades. Now, but it's a tough political sell because no one wants to actually pay for the roads that they think they've already paid for through a gas tax and the roads that should be free. So the result was that numerous cities had talked about doing a congestion charge for decades, but no one had actually done it because they couldn't get past the Stargate. London was one of those cities, but by the late 1990s, traffic was so bad that traffic in London was moving at the same speed it was, or lower speed than when they had carriages in the Victorian age. And then a convergence of events occurred to change the political dynamic, the most important being the election of a new mayor, Ken Livingstone, who had committed to the charge during the campaign. Now, Red Ken Livingstone, as he was known, is unapologetically a man of the left. He counts Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez as among his closest friends. He made a sport of antagonizing Margaret Thatcher while she was prime minister. Livingstone had about the most unlikely profile you can imagine of a candidate, of someone who would adopt a market road pricing policy favored by free market economists. But embrace it he did because it conformed with his environmental views and might be a way out of London's environmental nightmare, congestion nightmare. So there are many ways this thing could blow up, okay? So think about the times it's been proposed in San Francisco. The initiative would impact a lot of people's lives. It had to be done all at once, not street by street, to work it, and it had never been done before on this scale ever anywhere. So his political advisor said, don't do it. Because if it didn't work, he could kiss his next term goodbye. The media said it would be an unmitigated disaster. The quote from a rabbi in the Guardian newspaper was typical. It said, my synagogue was bombed during the war, but Livingstone is going to do more damage than the Germans. But he didn't panic, because what he did was he took failure seriously. And he and his team took a lot of extraordinary steps to make sure that this went well. They tested, they planned, they tested again. They were fanatical about mapping out every single risk. And borrowing from the military, they did some war gaming of everything that could go wrong. So 2 weeks before the launch, Transport for London, they had a dry run. It was kind of like, think of it like they wanted to put their control room to the test. It was kind of like a preseason game, but with the pads on. They would get calls all day long to respond to potential crises. Their day of war games started at 7 a.m. The team had just sat down for coffee, and suddenly a call comes in. A major traffic accident has caused a huge bottleneck on a major road bordering the charging zone. The team is ready for it. Vehicles entering the zone at the detour site are electronically flagged and they won't be charged. Then at 8 a.m., another call. The communications between the cameras and the hub have broken down. There's no way to track vehicles coming into the zone. Again, they're ready for it. They've got a backup computer system that they go to. The majority of drivers should be detected.
Someone has jumped off Tower Bridge.
And it went like that all day long. But they were ready for it. They were able to handle everything that was thrown at them. They were ready. Now, just in case, before the launch, they sent a woman named Kate, who is actually one of my colleagues, to walk the entire route around the charge zone, 26 miles, armed with a pen and a piece of paper. And her assignment was to make sure that nothing was going to happen on the road network without them knowing about it. No public works scaffolding, no hole about to be dug. It's 5:30 a.m., the day of the launch. Mayor Livingston steps out of his flat, and flash, 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 he's mobbed by photographers. They all want a picture of the mayor on the day that they believe will be his Waterloo. But the day didn't end in disaster. It ended in triumph. Everything went smoothly. There wasn't a single glitch. The streets were actually eerily quiet that day. And remember those gloom and doom headlines? Well, here are the headlines from the day after the launch. So he told me that was one of the, that those headlines were one of the best days of his lives. So why did the story have a happy ending? Because Ken Livingston knew it could have a tragic ending. As the mayor himself put it, nothing in public life has turned out better than I hoped for until now. Now, this brings us to the last phase of the journey that we're going to talk about tonight, and that's the results phase. So that means we're near the end of the speech. Now, recall the Greek myth about Sisyphus pushing a rock up a hill. Now, those who work in government know, and there's some of you over there, you know the public sector hill is really tough. I've worked in government, the private sector, nonprofit sector, and the hill is steeper in the private sector. It just is. I mean, in the public sector, because you've got these invisible forces, politics, culture, incentives, that just make it uniquely challenging. Now, the Sisyphus myth and the Sisyphus trap tells us that success is heavily dependent on the people who are actually trying to get big things done. And to succeed actually requires having people who are deeply, deeply skilled at navigating the public sector terrain. Now, I like to think of these people as kind of like the Indiana Jones of government, because when they see the golden idol that's just there, it looks like they can grab, instead they look around for where the poison darts are going to be. And the people like this, people like Dwight Inc. Now, Dwight doesn't look very much like Indiana Jones. He looks probably, he's an unassuming guy, bald, short, and so forth. But Dwight was one of those unsung heroes. The guy behind all the presidents and the cabinet secretaries who got all the attention when government embarks upon history-making achievements. Dwight worked at a senior level, the senior, most senior level for 7 consecutive American presidents. An incredible feat. Dwight is now in his 80s, and the pictures that you see on his wall are the pictures of the great people in history. He helped Eisenhower write the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And he was there when Kennedy signed it. He was the guy that LBJ turned to lead the Alaska earthquake recovery. If all of you remember, it was the biggest earthquake in North American history. Dwight told me he was watching the news of the earthquake at home with his wife, and he said he felt sorry for the person who was going to have to actually put this thing back together again. 2 days later, he got a call from LBJ, and he said, Dwight, you're going to Alaska. He helped Johnson also create the Department of Housing and launch the War on Poverty. He was in charge of new federalism for Richard Nixon and civil service reform for Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan came in and actually put Dwight in charge of shutting down the first federal agency to actually be shut down in 50 years. Not a pleasant task for a civil servant, but he got the job done. He was even kidnapped once by Colombian drug lords while leading the war on drugs for the State Department. Soon after, Dwight retired. Now, the one story I love about Dwight is he was in a meeting when Kennedy was just first elected, and they didn't have the National Security Council completely done, so Dwight, a holdover, was sitting in a meeting on the nuclear test ban, limited nuclear test ban treaty. And Dwight, in that meeting, Arthur Schlesinger was there, of course, you know, who was the president's historian, very, very close to the Kennedy family. And Dwight was arguing for the limited nuclear test ban treaty, and Schlesinger was arguing against it. And they got into really, really heated argument. They got all red-faced and everything. And Dwight, then, after the meeting, he went back and he tendered his resignation, because he figured that, look, the Kennedys aren't going to want him around anymore, this holdover who's been arguing with someone so close to the family. And the funniest thing was, during this meeting, who was looking over, we realized, but it was Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy was watching this, and so Dwight just said, you know what, I'm in so much trouble right now. And so he thought he'd have to have another career, go into the private sector. But actually, he went back, and that next meeting, he was invited back, and Arthur Schlesinger was gone, and Dwight was there. And what that story shows us is the importance of courage and speaking up for what you believe in. Our nation faces very serious challenges today, and what is most sobering, however, is the difficulty that we've been having actually tackling our big challenges. And there's only one way out of our predicament, and that's to choose wisely which policies we pursue and then to execute those effectively. Our hope is that this book leaves a lot of public officials and leaves all of you a little better equipped to navigate the process of making our government better so that we can all have a better future. Thank you very much. Do I stay up here?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Right.
And you've got water?
I got water.
Good shape. Great. Our thanks to William Eggers, co-author of the book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. Thanks for your comments this evening. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be moderating tonight's audience question period. We have a lot of questions here for you, and we're about to begin. Many of the questions, I realize, address your new book's central theme, being the process of idea through implementation. So let me begin, if I may, with this question. How would you rate the Obama campaign for its design and implementation strategies during the election process of 2008?
You know, that's a great question, because I actually wrote a whole thing that didn't make it into the book about how the campaign actually performed from the standpoint of execution. It was, I think almost all political professionals would say, it was one of the most kind of flawlessly executed campaigns. And they had their idea, and they stuck to that idea. They designed it. They basically did a lot of things, which crowdsourced, were in terms of bringing in a lot of people to help them to kind of execute that. And in the face of some hard things, they stuck with it. He kept, you know, the campaign really kept their eye on the goal in the end. So I think, you know, from an execution standpoint, it was really a model. And what, you know, if more government initiatives actually operated like that, it'd be easy. But you know what? In a campaign, you don't have to go through Congress, right? And that ends up being a big barrier to doing things that smoothly.
Let's talk just for a moment about the Marshall Plan. You write a lot about it, and it's a quintessential example that you use. And you refer to it as an example of a successful government program. Might not the Obama stimulus plan be a modern-day version of the Marshall Plan, but this time it's actually for us?
I've not thought about it that way. I would say, just on the Marshall Plan, what was interesting about it was that when the Marshall Plan was first proposed, as a lot of you might remember, it was actually not terribly popular. that the American public was really split about whether this made a lot of sense to put billions and billions of dollars into Europe and all that effort. And but what was interesting about how they did it was rather than try to ram it through or anything, what they did was they allowed for a lot of thoughtful legislative debate. And they actually sent a lot of the senators and others who were not quite convinced it was the right thing, they sent them to Europe to actually take a look at it. And they involved them, but then they also had, which I thought was remarkable, a big public relations campaign where they did town hall meetings and they went across America, really, to try to make the case for this. It was a huge effort. There was buttons, there was everything involved at that time. And I think it was really an exemplary process for actually how to go about that. Because when you look at these major initiatives like we did time and time again, there's very, very few really successful initiatives that we found that actually were done on a strictly partisan basis. Most of the successes, you had bipartisan cooperation, and you had the majority of the American people really behind them.
Go ahead. This is a broad question. What are the best managed government programs?
You know, it's funny, as I've been doing a lot of radio programs, a lot of ranting and raving people are doing on the radio nowadays, and when I actually will say, well, you know, we have had a lot of failures recently, but we've had some real successes in the last 30 years, people look at me sometimes like I'm a crazy person, that they can't think of it, but we've actually had some really good successes. Let's look at a few of them. One of them was acid rain reduction, which I mentioned, a great environmental success. Another one was crime reduction. In American cities, we've seen 50, 60, 70% reductions in crime over the last 15 years. And that was due to really, really strong execution in many respects. Welfare reform, where it was a bipartisan initiative between President Clinton, Republican Congress, and also the states involved, very, very successful initiative, huge reductions in caseloads. A lot of people got into work. And one of the reasons why welfare reform worked was because it had already been tried in the states, like in Wisconsin, Wyoming, in cities. And so when I talked to the person who drafted the bill in Congress, what he said was that essentially we're just riding a wave now. We've already seen the different successes locally, and so it's easy now to craft a bill that just builds on that. And then they gave a lot of flexibility to states for how they could actually implement it. And I think that's a really good model, where you try things out in a small basis, you do a lot of piloting, a lot of prototyping, you see what works before you try to go at scale across the whole country.
Well, how does one best regulate big government without increasing the size of its bureaucracy? Is that even possible?
Regulate big government.
Federal government, I
think. Well, actually, it's funny because regulating government is one of our big problems today. If you're a government official, if you're one of the senior executives that I talked about, what we call the bridgers, you are faced with so many rules and regulations and constraints on how to manage. When we did our survey, we asked, what is the biggest reason why we're having problems today? And they cited partisanship, they cited other areas, but what they said was this, all these administrative rules and constraints and everything that actually make it impossible to actually do anything if you're in government. We've made that hill for Sisyphus a lot steeper than it was. And so, in fact, what we need to do is deregulate our government a lot. We need to free up the people who work in there, because what happens whenever there's any kind of a scandal, then we put more and more restrictions on them because we assume that everyone in government is a crook, right? And that's kind of how we do things. Those of you who work in the private sector, if you had the same kind of constraints, you'd find it incredibly frustrating. And we need to be more aware of that, and we need to take steps to actually remove a lot of those.
Well, let's identify ourselves just for a moment. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is William Eggers, author and commentator, who is discussing when government works and when government doesn't work. Here's an example of, in my opinion, with this question of maybe where government works. It's about the TSA. After 9/11, under the leadership of Norm Mineta, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, was established to ensure the security of air travel. How would you rate the TSA? Was the TSA designed and implemented effectively, in your opinion?
You know, it's funny, you mention TSA sometimes in polite company, and everyone's got kind of a story to tell about TSA. Let's just say, charitably, it wasn't exactly known for its customer service in its first few years, right? But it's actually interesting. We talk about TSA in the book because there's a positive story. A new director came in several years after it had been in operation named Kip Hawley. And Kip's problem, what he said was that there's 55,000 screeners there. There's got to be a lot of those screeners with really good ideas for how to make things a little bit easier for all of you when you go through the screening process while keeping us safe. But right now, there's no way for him to get those ideas because there's all these layers of management and so forth. And so he was trying to find a way to reach down and get the ideas from individual screeners, which is a wonderful thing to do in government. And what he did was he came up with something called the Idea Factory. And they using collaboration technology, using simple wiki technology and an intranet, they put something up that allowed any TSA employee to submit ideas for improving TSA operations, making customer service better, and so forth. And a lot of agencies have idea suggestion boxes, and they don't go anyplace. But what happened was that not only would they get to submit the ideas, but other TSA employees would get to vote on whether they were good ideas or not. They participated in debate. And Kip actually was there participating in these forums. Well, what happened was that over time, a lot of these ideas actually became adopted. You know, simple ones for if any of you have ever been through airport security into airport where they have diamond lanes and black lanes and others for fast travelers and slower travelers that came from this idea factory. They also had another one called just simply job switching. Over time, dozens and dozens of ideas coming from the front line were actually implemented at TSA, and I think it's made it a much better agency. But it's a wonderful example of how to, again, break through of the Tolstoy syndrome by essentially reaching out to a much more diverse group of people to help you come up with good ideas.
Well, I just have a real-life example myself in terms of the Tolstoy syndrome. Thanks for the invitation to segue here. I was recently visiting a customer in the heavy construction business, and he had several pictures of the Big Dig on his office wall, which I know you write extensively about in your book. So I told him about your book, because I was reading it at the time. It was just last week, and what you refer to as the Tolstoy syndrome, which is, I think, seeing the possibilities, only the possibilities that you want to see. That was the reason for ignoring the real cause of the leaking ceiling bolts. Then he proceeded to tell me that he had worked for 3 years on the Big Dig project, and I think at a fairly high level. I thought what you wrote about in the book was very interesting. Could you elaborate just a little bit about that as an example of a project?
Sure.
And the Tolstoy syndrome?
You know, if any of you over the years have been in Boston and traveled there, you know about the Big Dig because it led to a lot of traffic. It was essentially one of our biggest urban infrastructure projects ever. And it was supposed to cost a couple million dollars, and the federal government put in a lot of the money, and it ended up being huge cost overruns. It took decades to actually finish, and they actually had a collapsing tunnel, which actually ended up killing a woman. And it was a pretty horrendous process overall. And one of the problems with the Big Dig was that they were actually spending mostly federal money. And when you're spending other people's money, those kind of cost overruns and those other things end up occurring. But what we write about in the book, we call the case of the red herring bolt, essentially, where a bolt kept on slipping. The bolts kept slipping, and they kept on misdiagnosing why they were slipping. They didn't look at the obvious thing because they could only see it in a certain way. And basically, over time, then that ended up in the collapsing of the tunnel. But what occurred with the Big Dig was simply this notion of they wanted to see it in a certain way, and they refused to look at kind of alternative viewpoints and see it in a way differently. And the Big Dig, you know, a lot of infrastructure projects we looked at have massive cost overruns, massive problems. And I think, you know, we need to spend a lot of time figuring out how to do those better. And, you know, one of the things that we found is that the more that the money for infrastructure projects tends to come from the locality itself, then a little bit more efficiently that they're actually provided.
Well, this next question has to do with comparing China's form of government to ours. China's form of government has been referred to as authoritarian capitalism. How would you compare their form of capitalism to ours? Which form of capitalism can take ideas and then implement them most effectively?
Oh, you know, it's an interesting question. Our first, before we called the book If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, the name for it was actually Mussolini's Curse. And so why did we call it that? Is because of, everyone used to always say about Mussolini what? That he can make the trains run, at least he can make the trains run on time, right? Well, it turns out that that's actually a bit of a myth that actually happened. But it's this longing we often have in times like these, when everything seems to be going wrong, when everyone's kind of screaming at each other, we kind of have that longing for these more authoritarian forms of government where they're just going to get things done. And you remember during the Olympics, and you know, they built all of these incredible projects, and they were built fairly quickly, and everything seemed to go so smoothly, the Olympics in China. And there's a lot of articles at the time saying, why can't we as a democracy do it that well? Why can't we do it as quickly? And so it's this interesting kind of longing. And actually, it's a big reason why we wrote that book, because we do believe that we can be successful there. It's always going to be a little bit tougher. There's always going to be more political obstacles. There's always going to be a little bit more debate. But I think that's the price. I don't think any of us would give it up for a second for a little bit more efficiency, that freedom to actually have that debate.
The government is spending more and more on Washington-based consultants. And probably one could say the role of lobbyists has also been extremely active. They're doing this as more government projects get initiated. What do you think about this, the use of consultants?
Well, as a consultant.
Right. That's why I asked the question.
I think it's a wonderful, very smart thing to do. I did write another book dealing with this issue called kind of governing by network, and it's what it is really is that the complexity of our problems today, the complexity of things, mean that whether it's a private company, whether it's the government or any organization, when you look at a lot of the big things that we got done over time, they weren't done by one agency or another. They're usually done by a network of different agencies, federal, local government, and often by university scientists and others, and a lot of consultants very often. The Manhattan Project actually had over 50,000 academics, scientists, researchers who are non-government who are actually working on that, and actually only 5,000 government officials. When we decided to put a man on the moon, NASA was really small. It actually only had about 5,000 people. Now, there's no way NASA would be able to realize putting a man on the moon within a decade with that amount of people. So what they had to do is they had to use, again, they had to go into the academic areas, they had to go into scientists, contractors, consultants, and bring them in. And over time, about 60,000, 69,000 were actually employed to help us realize that goal of putting a man on the moon. And over time, then we're able to very quickly scale back again. So I actually think that there's a lot of benefits, actually, for using people from the outside who have done a lot of these projects time and time again.
Mr. Eggers, one of my earlier questions had to do with comparing the Marshall Plan to the Obama stimulus plan. So here's a follow-up to that. In a time of economic despair and while we're in a recession, are you in favor of government expansion and even more stimulus spending?
Well, what we do in the book is the book really takes a process look at government in general. Now, that this question is about the role of government, what government should do in the first place. And that's a really, really important question to answer, because if you don't answer that, then a lot of other things don't make sense. But what we do in the book is we really try to address the second question, which is once you decide what to do, how do you actually execute it? And one of the things that we say in the book and elsewhere is that it doesn't matter whether you're a liberal who wants universal health care or you're a conservative who wants to make government smaller and you want to have school vouchers and other things, execution is actually really, really important. And I've been working in government reform for over two decades now. And believe me, I've been involved in many, many examples of actually trying to find cost savings in government, trying to trim agencies. And one thing I can tell you is that actually making government smaller is a lot harder, requires a lot more execution than actually launching a new program, a lot more attention to that. And too often, I think people who believe that government should be smaller don't spend enough time thinking about that. They want to just come up with an idea and then kind of toss that over the wall, and then when it doesn't work, they blame it on the bureaucrats. And so I think it's really important for people on both sides of the aisle with all sorts of ideologies to understand this, to understand how government really works, and get out of this notion of just the blame game and just saying it's all someone else's fault.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is William Eggers, author and commentator, who is discussing when government works and when it doesn't. Mr. Eggers, in the book, you talk about how General MacArthur took charge in Japan after their surrender. For 6 years, MacArthur was successful in integrating the civilian and military leadership. Can you compare this is really kind of an unfair question, can you compare this to the role that Paul Bremer played after the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq?
I'll somewhat answer the question. We did look at Iraq when we wrote this book, because how can you not look at it? But there's also already been so much that's said about it. Now, in terms of Iraq, we actually fell into a number of the traps that we talk about in the book, and certainly one of those traps was Tolstoy syndrome, where when the decision was finally made to go in, and when they're looking at Reconstruction, what they failed to do is there's a lot of people in the State Department and elsewhere who had a lot of knowledge, who had been looking at this as part of a democracy in Iraq project for many years, who actually argued about all the things that could go wrong and all the different problems and possibilities. And what happened was that a lot of the administration just didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear contrary voices, and they were actually then shut out of the process. One guy named Tom Warrick, who was one of them, was kind of infamously kicked off the team by Rumsfeld. And I think, so that was a very, very big problem there. What we found was that they did more war gaming in terms of looking at London congestion pricing in a way than we did looking at the aftermath of Iraq. And so obviously a huge problem. They fell into also the overconfidence trap, where we simply believed we'd obviously be greeted as liberators and so forth. And a lot of those problems. We learned, I think, a lot of lessons from Iraq and from an execution standpoint. And I think, you know, one thing we then have to say is with the surge, we have another thing called the reevaluation phase, which we didn't talk about, which is where you're reevaluating your initiative and deciding, you know, looking at it over time and seeing whether it worked or not. And in this case, they did a really good job of reevaluating what was working or not working in Iraq. And in this case, in some of the provinces, you had some really, really terrific generals and other soldiers who were basically using this method, and then they decided to adopt it over. But there was against a lot of opposition. So I think there was some real, real problems there. But in the end, with the surge, I think you also have a very positive story of being able to overcome a lot of these traps that they fell into initially.
Well, I almost hesitate to ask this question. It's such a short question with such a huge possibility of answers. But maybe you can highlight an answer here. How can healthcare reform be effectively implemented?
I'll try to keep it really short, because, you know, the healthcare reform, what it illustrates is actually one of the big issues and one of the big conundrums that we face today. Because for healthcare reform to happen, two things need to actually occur. First, you need to get the bill past Congress, right? And then secondly, you actually need to have a plan that will work in the real world. Now, in some cases, in many cases, those two things actually end up contradicting each other, right? Because what happens with a lot of legislative bills is that to basically get enough support and to get different legislators on board, you end up kind of having to add a lot to it and change the design around and put in a lot of kind of extra things into the bill that you might not have wanted in terms of a pure design. So I think that's one of the issues that we're facing with healthcare right now. It's kind of, healthcare is kind of right outside that Stargate now, and they're trying to get it through and trying to, you know, get the number of votes. But I think what we have to understand is the big question is whether this will actually work in the real world. And that's the most important question, because you don't have success just by getting a bill passed. And in fact, it's going to occur over time. It won't be actually implemented until 2014, 2015, likely. And so I think it's very early. It's very early to say. I think you can find some aspects of there. They're going to do a lot of pilot projects. They're going to try to be agile and learn from them. They've got innovation centers that they're thinking about. But one of the things is that we don't know exactly how a lot of this is going to work in the real world. That with welfare reform, one of the things we did know was that we had tried a lot in many states before they actually passed the 94 welfare reform bill.
Well, that's a great answer. I applaud you for it on a question that could take many, many programs here at the Commonwealth Club. This is an interesting one. What do you see government doing to better work with industry? Let me just add my own tail onto it, both small business and big business.
Well, I think, again, when you look at most of these big initiatives today, these initiatives are not just government alone. Government's involving contractors, they're involving industry, they're involving academics in it. And so the key skill you need as a public official today is the ability to do that. And I think we've had some great examples. The person who actually really helped get us to the moon was a guy named James Webb. James Webb was the head of NASA when President Kennedy announced this. And what Webb did was he had to basically find a way to work with industry and, you know, a lot of the defense contractors, the space companies, and everything else to actually figure out how to cobble them all together to do this. One of the funny things that Webb said afterwards is essentially when you look at the aircraft that was going up, that it was actually all put together with kind of low-cost bids in the end, which is a little bit scary. And I think that we need to recognize today, kind of move away from an ideological fight about whether we should privatize or not privatize or more government or less government, and realize that for almost all these initiatives, you have partnerships with the public sector and the private sector. They're going to have to be able to work much, much more closely together. And the more closely together they can work, I think the more public value that you can actually create. And so whether it's infrastructure here in California, where the public sector alone doesn't really build much of the infrastructure, and so you're going to need to do a lot more in terms of public-private partnership, but certainly in the healthcare arena also.
Well, I hate to see this program end, and it's not for another minute or two, but we only have time for one last question. What is your judgment on Al Gore's Reinventing Government program of the late 90s?
Well, the Reinventing Government program was actually based off the National Performance Review, off the Texas Performance Review, which is a program that I had the opportunity to manage for several years. And I think that it had a lot of wonderful aspects to it, because one of the things that the Reinventing Government program did was they tried to really create innovation in a lot of the different federal agencies. And they had Hammer Awards that they would give for people who did innovation. And a lot of time and attention went into that, at least the first couple years. Now, one of the overall issues with it didn't actually end up radically restructuring or reforming the federal government. There's a lot of kind of small wins with it. And one of the reasons being is that, you know, this stuff is not very sexy, the things that we've talked about, you know, management reform, government reform, and innovation. And what happens is politicians and others kind of lose interest after the first couple of years and they move on to something else. And when that happens, I think then that also the interest wanes a little bit in these programs. And so, you know, I believe that this is absolutely, absolutely critical. And it's the most important kind of government issue we have of the day. And certainly when you think about California and where the state is at and the troubles the state has had and the very difficult, governable kind of nature of the state. I think for the next governor of California, this sort of notion of making government work better and restructuring it and making it governable is there couldn't be a more important issue. And so I would just hope that it becomes part of the campaign debate here.
Well, something we don't always do at the Commonwealth Club, but I want to thank all of those in the audience for the wonderful questions that you submitted. And our special thanks go tonight to William Eggers, co-author of the book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. And we also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Tobey Family Foundation. I'm Joe Epstein. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.